This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
All right, well, Sandy Rios with you, not Tony Perkins. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association. I do the morning show for American Family Radio. I talk news and politics every day. I'm just talking it at a different time of the day. So Tony is away doing something important, I'm confident. Well, this is an incredible week in Washington. Honestly, only President Trump could find himself with a four-day week that has the following things. Midnight on Friday night, the government will shut down if funding is not agreed upon. It is the end of the 100-day marker for the President of the United States. There is health care to deal with. There's a push to pass a bill. There's tax reform that's being talked about. In the summer, we're going to get into the debt ceiling, which is absolutely phenomenal, upsetting when you talk about the amount of money that we owe. And there are disagreements. It's not like Republicans are on the same page, and certainly Democrats are always at war with them. So what's going to happen in this next 4 days? The Congress has been out of on recess, and a lot of complain because they've only worked 7 days in the month of April, seven work days. And that's been something that many of us have not quite understood. But I think over this vacation, they've done a number of meetings by phone, and they're coming back Tuesday evening. And so let's just see what happens. Well, to tell us what's going to happen is Congressman Tom Reed. He is with the New York's, he represents New York's 23rd District. He's done that since 2010. He's on the House Ways and Means Committee, which means he's right in the thick of all these financial decisions, and he's on the Subcommittee on Tax Policy. Congressman Reed, thank you for joining us on Washington Watch.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
All right, so now I gave you a bunch of headlines just then. In your mind, which makes you stay awake at night? Which ruined your vacation? Which one of those items?
Well, you know, the top priority as we return to Washington is keeping the government funded, keep the government open, and make sure that we're dealing with the border and the security issues that we face as American citizens.
Okay, well, let's talk about the border, because you know the Democrats want badly for you guys not to do an agreement by midnight so that the government will shut down so that they can blame Republicans, as they always do. On the other hand, President Trump promised every speech and every rally that he would build a wall, and Americans voted for him because they believed that, Congressman. And so how does House leadership come down on that issue? Will you be able to find a way to fund that wall by Friday night midnight?
I do believe we're not going to shut the government down. And I think what we're going to be able to do, and there's multiple tools available to us. I'm part of efforts to prioritize, make sure the government's kept open, but get the border security money funding going forward. And I think there's ways to do that outside of the shutdown debate. And I'm confident, given that we in the House and Senate and the White House are now all committed to building that wall and keeping us secure, we'll be able to do that and also keep the government open.
Now, that sounds like, okay, no offense, but that sounds like a little kabuki, because really, those two things are not compatible. How are you going to fund the wall, given that the Democrats are threatening? They're saying no way, they're digging their heels in, and the deadline's Friday night. How would you do that?
Well, there's the vehicles like a supplemental request that could be utilized to get the money through the border security efforts. There are things that are dealt with at the same time we deal with the government funding and keeping the lights on. So I think at the end of the day, we'll figure a path forward. I've been part of efforts to try to bring people together, keep government open, but at the same time, make sure those investments are being made at our border to keep us secure.
You know, Congressman, I guess I have to say, and I'm sure you know this, the American people really do expect this from you all. I mean, most of Congress campaigned on this. I think that one of the concerns is that Congressman Ryan, Leader Ryan, has not been good on this issue. In fact, has been at odds with the president. In fact, many of us, I remember well because I'm from Chicago, I remember when Speaker Ryan toured with Luis Gutierrez, who was an open borders, really a socialist, lobbying for things that really the Democratic Party embraced more than the Republican Party. So a lot of us are not confident that Speaker Ryan is committed to building this wall or that the leadership is. Can you assure us that you are?
I can. I can tell you I appreciate that input and that criticism. But at the end of the day, there's so many of us that believe in keeping our border secure, keeping us safe as American citizens. And I think we're going to be able to thread this needle, keep the government open, and make those investments at the border that we're talking about. And I think that's the right thing to do. I care about our safety first and foremost. And I'll tell you, I think come Friday, we'll be able to demonstrate that we got this taken care of.
Okay. Well, I want that to be true, so I'm going to take you. I'll sleep better tonight. All right. The next thing I'm going to ask you about, because there are so many others, the health care bill. Of course, we are hearing that there have been all kinds of negotiations over this break, all kinds of conversations. I'm sure you've been part of them. We know that the Freedom Caucus have been the pulling this bill to the right. And we know that the Tuesday Morning Group, which is more moderate, has been pulling it to the left. And we know that the president is pressuring all of you to come to an agreement so that a bill can be passed this week. So what do you think's going to happen?
I think it's probably not realistic to think this week. I think next week is more realistic, just to be open and honest with you. But I believe that the last 2 weeks has given us that deep breath that I think members needed. You know, it was 6 weeks straight that we were working in D.C. And I think at the end of the day, there was a lot of emotion. There was a lot of members that were too close to it. And they went back and, you know, as we do town halls and we listen to folks, I think that's going to give us new energy to come to the table and thread this compromise that's been kicked around between the hard right and the Tuesday group, as you said, and the Freedom Caucus group. And I think we can have a bill that respects states' rights and state waiver ability and allows us to move forward, to move on to health care, because we're still going to have to deal with health care. We're dealing with health insurance to a great deal with this bill, but health care has to be part of this equation. That's going to be a longer-term debate as we go forward.
You know, this is such, I'm hearing, still hearing, unfortunately, the news media is not covering this, but the problems that people are having with health care right now are still there, and they are critical. And they're so serious. I just heard a story just a few nights ago about a young man, actually, a pastor of a church who got deathly ill, and he was taken to the hospital and was in emergency all night long and could never see anyone. The healthcare system is kind of breaking down. I've heard, again, nightmare stories. I'm sure you have, too, as a congressman. You hear all these stories of people's premiums just killing them and the deductibles going up. This is actually, don't you think, this is a good time for a free market solution? I mean, if you're ever going to repeal Obamacare and have a free market solution, it seems like this would be the time. Don't you think so?
I agree. I'm hearing those horror stories just as you are, and how healthcare in America is collapsing, and health insurance in particular is collapsing immediately. We just talked to an insurance carrier, Blue Cross Blue Shield, that are indicating premium increases of minimum 20 up to 50%. That's not coverage for anyone. And I'll tell you, that's why we also have to deal with health insurance, but at the same time, and bring competitive forces to health insurance, but we also have to bring the same to health care. And that's why this is a two-step process, in my opinion.
You know, Congressman, I think one of the things that distresses me, I'm not an economist, but, you know, I grew up understanding free markets and capitalism in its best definition, not crony capitalism. And I do believe that free markets can solve a lot of these problems. And I find myself wondering if there is enough knowledge and just basic understanding of free market principles in the Congress to tackle these kinds of issues. What do you think about that?
I do believe that the knowledge is there. I believe the commitment is another issue, because so many folks are so much pushing this big government. I'll tell you, we have a very moderate district to a degree in certain sections of it. And I hear single payer, where they want complete government run and controlled health care as the solution. So what we need to do is educate the American people as to what we're trying to do with market principles and take on this big government mindset that seems to be coming from our coastlines, where they're saying we in government know best and that's where the solution should be. I adamantly disagree with that. And I think at the end of the day, the American people agree more with us than they do with that big government mantra.
I think so, and I do think that it would, I don't know how you would do this, because obviously the left has the larger megaphone, but, you know, they didn't win the last election, I have to say that, in spite of the fact that conservatives don't have as much of a megaphone. But my point is, it's hard for you guys sometimes to get your message out, but then sometimes I feel like that's not a strength of the Republican Party messaging. And it seems like this is a time for teaching. You know, that's what Newt Gingrich does so beautifully. He not only takes political positions, but he actually teaches about the layers and the understanding. And sometimes I think that's missing among members of Congress to explain why they feel the way they feel and explain that there is a, I know that Paul Ryan has talked about his better way, but perhaps a little teaching on what a better way means would be in order. Congressman, we need to talk about taxes because you're on the subcommittee for taxes, and Donald Trump says he's going to, unveil some sort of a plan this week. You guys have a plan, and then he has a plan, and they're not the same. Is that right?
Well, we'll wait to see what happens on Wednesday, but I think that's a positive development on tax reform. But to your point about educating, and that's why I do town halls, and I encourage my colleagues on the Republican side of the aisle to embrace their constituents, stand in front of their constituents. We had 1,000 folks yelling at us, for example, just a month ago, and we've done 16 of these since the election. And what I try to do is when you get through the yelling and screaming, it is amazing how you can educate people, you can persuade people with our principles, so long as you're committed to it and stand there and have the formal debate. And as we go into tax reform, this is critical. And that's why we're doing hearings on the committee. That's why we're taking our concepts in the better way, dovetailing, hopefully, with the White House, where they see some improvements that possibly they can bring to the table. But until that occurs, we in the House, on the Ways and Means Committee in particular, are going to push forward the ideas that are bold, generational, transformational tax reform that's going to simplify, make the code competitive, and make it fair for everyone. To me, those are principles that should guide us as we deal with tax reform going forward.
Now, are you talking about corporate as well as individual taxes, tax code? Or are you talking about, one?
I have put a marker down that if it's good for corporations to reform the code, it's good for individuals, and it's good for mom-and-pop shops with these small businesses that are pass-through entities, where you do your taxes on your individual side of the equation for small businesses in America mostly. So for me, it's good for all, and that's what we got to focus on, and I think that's won the day as we go forward with tax reform.
Well, of course, one of the disadvantages you have on that is that at least half of the American population doesn't even pay taxes, and you've got the so-called wealthy paying almost all of the so-called wealthy, the 1% paying something like, 35%, something like that, or even more. And so no matter if you reduce taxes, no matter what you do, they're going to say it's you've reduced taxes for the wealthy because they're the only ones paying tax for the most part.
That's the only ones paying. Yeah, that's a fair point.
It's really, you know, you guys are in a real conundrum with that, and that's another thing where messaging, I guess, is going to be key to all of this. Well, Congressman, if you were to kind of ask your constituents what they could do, we only have a minute left here, what would you ask from us that our constituents and trying to work with you and support, not always be critics, what could we do?
I would ask engage. Go silent. Don't think because we won the last election that there's no work to be done. This is most important that we engage on our local communities or be a local leader, weigh in on these debates. Don't be shy because the other side is obviously getting very vocal, and we need to make sure that pulpit is as loud as we possibly can make it. We can only do that with the American people that are standing with us.
Yes, and we can do that by coming to town hall meetings. And did you, 30 seconds here, did you experience the left really co-opting your town halls? Or you seem to indicate they were successful, so I'm assuming they did not manage to sabotage
them. No, there was a lot of them that... No, there was a lot. If you look at the tapes, you can see we made some national news on it. But once we stood through the hour of being yelled at, I got 11 older brothers and sisters, and I knew if you believe in who you are, you believe in what you're doing, at the end of the day, you can cut through that clutter and those attacks.
All right. Well, Congressman Tom Reed, it's very nice to meet you over the phone and to have a chance to talk to you. So we appreciate your time and your service to this country in this manner. Thank you, sir.
Well, you too. God bless. Take care.
Okay, same to you. All right, Sandy Rios coming back with some of the news in just a second. Filling in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch.
Your mission is to find Granny and get that sauce.
Affirmative.
1 million moms in association with American Family Studios introduces Ryan DeFrades, Secret Agent.
I'm Ryan DeFrades. I work alone.
Ryan is arrogant and reckless until the day he's paired with a very unlikely partner.
No way! I can do this alone, without anyone's help, much less my mom's.
Look, Ryan.
She's my mom!
Ryan DeFrades' Secret Agent is the new action-adventure series featuring a young spy with a whole lot to learn.
Mama's coming, so sweetie.
She's an agent. Get her, boys.
Each exciting, fun-filled episode teaches children important values, like honoring parents and respecting authority. And there's a brief wrap-up at the end that connects the story to a biblical illustration. Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent. Perfect for children ages 6 and over. Pre-order your copy today at afastore.net.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. It grieves us deeply as we see so many evidences of man's inhumanity to man. Most of you have seen pictures from Syria where Assad and his forces use nerve gas upon its citizens, picturing moms and dads desperately trying to breathe life into lifeless bodies. Our hearts cry out, "Oh God, how can this be?" Hear these words from Psalm 8, 16 through 18. The Lord is King forever and ever. The nations perish from his land. O Lord, you hear the desire of the afflicted. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear to do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed, so that man who is of the earth may strike terror no more. Do we see that the peace that we yet experience in America is far beyond what most peoples of all the world have ever been able to live under? Lord, give us hearts that pray for the embattled. This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson.
8 Days of Hope 13 is headed to Lafayette, Louisiana, June 4th to June 11th. Hi, I'm Steve Tiber with 8 Days of Hope. 8 Days of Hope is a faith-based ministry. We've gone all over the country to help families rebuild after natural disasters. We've helped almost 1,800 families rebuild their homes, sometimes from the ground up. Lafayette, Louisiana, and the whole state of Louisiana got hit by epic flooding last year in August. Almost 25 inches of rain fell, and almost $20 billion of damage was done. Literally 140,000 homes flooded. Think about that, 140,000 families waiting for somebody to be a glimpse of Jesus. You can be a skilled professional, or you can be somebody like me who's less skilled but wants to give back. Go to 8daysofhope.com. We provide the food and lodging, and you can learn a lot more about the ministry. And we can't wait to see you in Lafayette, Louisiana, June 4th to June 11th. For more information, go to 8daysofhope.com.
The president, I think, talking about this wall, is expressing a sign of weakness. He's saying, I can't control our borders. I have to build a wall.
I wonder if Nancy Pelosi has locks on her doors. Just wondering if she has any guards, because then that must mean she's weak, right? Oh, Sandy Rios with you, filling in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch. Nancy Pelosi's never-ending source of entertainment. Whether you want to laugh or if it's sardonic, you know, humor, I'm not sure. But she was not finished. She went on to talk about the border wall, which is so silly that you and I would want such a border. It's so silly that we'd want a door with a lock on our front, a front part of our houses. Just so silly. Silly, I guess, that Paul Ryan has a wall around his house or the Vatican has a wall around it. But I digress. Let's listen to what else Nancy Pelosi had to say about the wall.
The president talks about how tall it is, who's going to pay for it, and all the rest of that. But you have to come, you have to understand this part of the country. There's a community with a border going through it. The president, I think, talking about this wall is expressing a sign of weakness. He's saying, I can't control our borders. I have to build a wall.
So there's a community, you see, where the border is going to be built all along those thousands of miles. It's just, it's one big happy family community. Of course, the latest diversion is for them to talk about how it's going to, the wall is going to go through properties and place people on the wrong side of the border. And they're always managing, meaning who are they? I, the left, the opposition. They're always trying to find ways. You know, the American people really do want to be protected from the onslaught, whether it's MS-13 or whether it's out of control people coming across the border. It's putting such a strain on our resources, on our schools, on our hospitals, our medical care, our Social Security, bringing their relatives in, having babies. It's out of control. And the laws have not been enforced for such a long time. It's kind of interesting to me. I've known Senator Jeff Sessions for a long time and really admired him for a long time. In the last few years, of course, he has taken on this mantle of fighting for enforcement of laws, immigration laws that are on the books. He has been a lone person standing on the floor of that Senate hour after hour, giving speeches filled with information and truth and trying to make the Senate understand why a nation without a border is no nation at all. I want you to hear what Attorney General Sessions said this morning on Fox and Friends, and then I want to give you some stats about how much it costs us not to have a border. Here's Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
What we need to do is remind Congress and the American people that this president promised this. They voted for it in large numbers. It was one of the great strengths in his campaign. It was certainly one of the reasons I believe that he should be elected president, and I supported him. So Congress can find a host of ways to pay for this wall. It can be done through people who come to our country through Mexico, fees and costs, and right. even fixing a tax abuse situation that I believe would make a lot of the payment toward the fixing it. So there's no problem with getting this done, and it's going to save a huge amount of money because we're going to continue to see this rapid decline in the number of people that come into our country right. illegally. Housing, deportation costs, all kinds of costs will be reduced when we reduce that flow. Throughout this whole process, I've been saying that whenever you come up with anything that actually fixes the problems, that is what does not pass. They'll pass anything as long as it doesn't work. They'll talk about fixing the border again and again and again, but when the chips are down, they back off. Let me tell you, we are this close. We've already changed the whole mentality at the border. President Trump has. Last month was the lowest month of illegal entries in 17 years. We get this barrier fixed. We get this, it'll save us so much money. It will reduce an amount of drugs and criminals that come into the country. It will make us more secure and safe from terrorists. It's going to be the end of illegality. And you know, we admit 1,000,001 people each year lawfully into America. So we're not ending immigration. We're just ending illegal immigration. The American people have asked for it for 30 years. It's time for the politicians to deliver once and for all, and we can do it.
All right, so that's Attorney General Sessions. And Center for Immigration Studies just put out a study. They are the think tank for the pro-enforcement of immigration laws organization. How radical is that? And this is what they say. An estimated $12 to $15 billion, the cost of the wall, which is $12 to $15 billion, the estimated, would quickly be offset by the savings to the government if fewer illegal immigrants arrive in the country over the next decade. The Center for Immigration Studies found only a small portion of the population of people who are expected to attempt an illegal crossing in the next decade, somewhere between 9 and 12%, would have to be stopped for the wall to totally pay for itself. They went on to estimate the cost of illegal immigrants. The low estimate, and that this does not even include the cost of their children. This is just the cost, and this is offset with the taxes that they might pay through payroll, is $75,000 per illegal immigrant in a lifetime. And that includes costs of education and health care. And those are low cost, low estimates, not high ones. And then it goes on, the Center for Immigration Studies study goes on to say, if Trump's border wall stopped between 160,000 and 200,000 people from entering the country illegally, the savings would offset the expected cost of the wall. And then it goes on to say, if you factor in children of illegal immigrants, the estimate goes up to $95,000 per illegal immigrant. And the wall, by the way, could save taxpayers nearly $64 billion over the next decade. In half the crossings are stopped. Just half of them are stopped. More than three times the expected cost of the wall. Well, of course, since President Trump came into office, I think Senator Sessions just said, or Attorney General Sessions just said this, but I have read it's that illegal border crossings are down somewhere around 75%. So even without a wall, with just the threat of someone enforcing laws or people being sent back home, we have reduced, it looks like, illegal crossings by 75%. That's amazing. And you think of the cost savings of that. So there is really no excuse. It is time to act. And most of Congress campaigned on this. The Republicans certainly, most of the Republicans did. And now it's time to make good on their promises. We'll see what happens. I find myself, it's hard for me to understand the optimism of Congressman Reed, but we'll see. Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch. And when we return, a little sort of commentary on the French elections, which happened yesterday. France has suffered so much under all the terrorist attacks that they've had. And so they've had a very interesting election, and just a few comments on that after this. This is Sandy Rios on Washington Watch. We'll be right back.
Making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
Last week, all the indices ended in positive territory. That's after 2 weeks of declines. We saw the Dow up a half of 1%, and the NASDAQ and the S&P up about 1% or better on the week. So that was a pretty good week, and it looks like we're going to start off in a pretty good way. But one of the things that is being talked about right now is first quarter GDP. Yes, it's that time of year again. And we now have to start thinking about first quarter. Well, at the end of the week, on Friday, we get the first look. Remember, there are three to determine where we were from a GDP growth standpoint starting off the year. This is the Trump administration's first GDP report. It is coming out Friday, and it is the first look, and it is expected to be down. Well, on that news, it looks like Stanley Fisher, he's the vice chair of the Federal Reserve, came out and said, look, we are going to keep steady our course because we believe that 2017 is going to be a good year. The economy is going to see growth. The markets, he didn't say markets, I'm saying it, but the markets are going to obviously grow. It sure looks it. And we aren't changing our position on raising interest rates. So it really doesn't look like the Fed is going to waver, as some are talking about now, as a result of GDP being a little bit lower than expectations. Also, we get consumer confidence numbers this week. We're getting durable good numbers, a very important number, pending home sales, new home sales as well, consumer sentiment, and of course, as I said, that GDP number. It'll be an interesting week.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
Humiliated in spectacular fashion, voters in France sending a loud and strong message to the country's mainstream elites, rejecting the far-left candidates and sending the election into a runoff May 7th between populist Marine Le Pen and centrist Emmanuel Macron, both candidates sounding energized by the shift in the country's politics.
It is time to free the French people from arrogant elites who want to dictate their behavior because, yes, I am the candidate of the people.
Your duty to continue to pursue this vibrant commitment until the end and beyond. Never give up, never forget those months during which you have changed the course of our country.
In the final results, Macron had just over 23%, while Le Pen had 21%. And the reaction from French voters suggests this was not only welcomed, but long overdue.
We need a change in leadership, you know, after 5 years which have not been great.
I wanted to vote for France and to make sure that we make the good choice.
France needs to reform, and we need to make sure that it's done well and rapidly.
This is angry protesters clashed with the police and took to the streets, rioting, setting bonfires and burning cars. Some 29 protesters arrested. And so many folks waking up to these events and results, noting the similarities between the French election and our own election. Guys, it seems we've seen this story before.
Absolutely.
All right. So that was Griff Jenkins on Fox this morning. Now, here's the thing. The top two vote-getters, of course, are not with the main parties. Emmanuel Macron, 23.9%, and Marie Le Pen, 21%. Emmanuel Macron, who they expect to win in the runoff, which is going to be May the 7th, that's coming up quickly, you know, is not, he may be independent from the establishment technically, but he is a socialist. Let's just say Barack Obama was supporting him. His policies, he's all about the European Union and staying in it. He really is a leftist. It's really not that new. The socialists, just because of their moniker, their stock is down with François Hollande. They only got 6%. So he did not want to associate with the Socialist Party because François Hollande is so unpopular. And the Socialist candidate, of course, like I just said, got only 6% of the votes. So he sort of disassociated himself. But he is very much, I think you could describe him as a socialist. Marie Le Pen, on the other end, she comes from a political family. Her father has a history of making some anti-Semitic statements, at least what's been described as that. And she has tried to distance herself from that. She is the lone voice, well, with 21% of the French people, crying out about the massive amounts of immigration under the European Union. You know, there are no borders there. You don't have to show a passport. The currency now is the same because of this grand scheme of the European Union. In order to sort of create some sort of a monetary advantage, the Europeans gave up, you know, their rights to an individual culture. And that's why they have not been able to stop the immigration. The European Union has been the decider, as George W. Bush once famously said, to which countries get how many people. And so France has taken in countless numbers of people from especially North Africa who are Muslim by faith. They live in separate enclaves and they have not assimilated. And we know the story. We all know the story. We know about the attacks on Charlie Hebdo. We know about the attacks just last summer along that beautiful causeway with a truck killing all those people. We know about the attacks last week where a French policeman was killed. It's very difficult even to go to France as a tourist now. It's dangerous. The crime rate is so up, even in Paris, and the no-go zones are becoming more and more of a problem. France is in deep trouble. We have problems here, too. Yes, we do. But we are not where France is yet. And so this is a country that is really fighting for its survival and its national identity, which it gave up, really, when it gave up its sovereignty to the EU. That's what's happened with all of these countries. And Marie Le Pen wants to pull back membership in the European Union. She wants to pull back and reestablish French identity, the French language, and limit immigration. And sort much like the kinds of things we're hearing here from Donald Trump and from others, from many of us that are conservatives. Marie Le Pen, today, the headline is that she has stepped down as head of France's National Front Party. That was the party that her father was part of. She has, this is, as I understand it, a continuing effort to distance herself from her father's views that she's been trying to distance herself from for years. But now she's officially stepped down and hoping, I think, to draw a coalition. Now, most of the major players are throwing their support behind Macron. And so, I don't know. You know, I'm not French. I've been talking to Frenchmen, and I'm learning more and more about this. It doesn't sound like Marie Le Pen has much of a chance on May the 7th, but then who knows? Because we don't know what's going to happen in France, and we really don't know, like we don't know here, how the French people really feel. So we'll find out on May the 7th. And the other thing about Macron, which is really interesting, he's, what, 39? I think he's 39. He married his teacher. The teacher he had when he was 15, and she's 20, I think 26 years older than he is, which is just, I guess that's okay in France. Are we ready for that here? We've accepted a lot of things in this country, but that's one we have, that's a Rubicon we haven't, had to cross yet. So that's what's happening in France. It's just a fascinating story, and of course it does affect the entire world. One more thing, the Senate is being called to the White House for a North Korea briefing because things are heating up with North Korea. The Chinese are trying to intervene. North Korea is a real threat. Are they capable of hitting the West Coast or the West Coast of Canada? They just have a few more tests to go and they'll be all set. So it would be interesting to be a fly on the wall. Of course, as much leaking as there is, I'm sure we'll find out what was said when they go to the White House on Wednesday. All right, well, stay tuned because coming up next is David Limbaugh talking about his brand new book, The True Jesus. This is Sandy Rios on Washington Watch, filling in for Tony Perkins, back right after this.
Your mission is to find Granny and get that sauce.
Affirmative.
1 million moms, in association with American Family Studios, introduces Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent.
I'm
Ryan DeFreitas. I work alone.
Ryan is arrogant and reckless until the day he's paired with a very unlikely partner.
No way! I can do this alone, without anyone's help, much less my mom's.
Look, Ryan.
She's my mom!
Ryan DeFreitas' Secret Agent is the new action-adventure series featuring a young spy with a whole lot to learn.
Mama's coming, sweetie!
She's an agent! Get her, boys!
Each exciting, fun-filled episode teaches children important values, like honoring parents and respecting authority. And there's a brief wrap-up at the end that connects the story to a biblical illustration. Ryan DeFreitas' Secret Agent. Perfect for children ages 6 and over. Pre-order your copy today at afastore.net.
Consider serving with Friendships. It's an all-volunteer ministry providing aid to disaster victims, refugees, and the impoverished here at home and around the world. We're now taking applications. If you're available to serve without pay, you can be part of the crew reaching out to help people in need. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Join Norman Geisler, Richard Land, Michael Brown, Frank Turek, and others for Southern Evangelical Seminary's National Conference on Christian Apologetics. It's October 13th and 14th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Enjoy informative talks, a live debate, and a dialogue with Ken Ham from Answers in Genesis. Plus, there's the premiere of the American Family Association documentary, The God Who Speaks. Register by May 1st and receive a special gift. Visit ses.edu for details.
The All-American girl is not supposed to get pregnant in college. Hi, Kim Katola for Cradle My Heart Today. And Gwen Smith was not only frightened of losing her athletic scholarship, but her reputation as a good Christian girl seemed to be on the line as well. So Gwen decided to go to her appointment for that abortion anonymously. She used an alias. And she walked away determined to bury that mistake along with her unborn child. Like so many others, Gwen learned that we may choose abortion, but we cannot choose our consequences. Her guilt and grief persisted until Gwen sought help through an abortion recovery Bible study offered by a pregnancy help center. Today, she helps women see how God can turn us from broken into beautiful, bringing good out of our worst mistakes and sin. Find out more of Gwen's story and resources to find healing after abortion at cradlemyheart.org. Saving lives and healing hearts after abortion, one story at a time. CradleMyHeart.org.
The people today, they called you king. They think you are a messiah.
But you seem to ignore them. Aren't you going to be our king?
Who do you think I am?
You are the Son of God.
You can't have known this by what you know of me, Peter. It has been revealed to you by God. You are Peter, and on this rock, I will build my church.
All right, well, that's a clip from one of my favorite movies about Jesus and that Son of God. Love that movie. And, you know, we just got through Easter. This is Sandy Rios, by the way, filling in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch. We just talked about Easter. And, of course, at Easter, the wonderful thing is it gives us a chance to talk about the resurrection of Jesus. But, of course, for those of us that are followers of Jesus, we think about the resurrection every day. You know, our whole lives are devoted to the fact that Jesus conquered death. And because of him, we live, and we live every day and every minute of every day remembering that. David Limbaugh has written a brand new book called The True Jesus, and it's uncovering the divinity of Christ in the Gospels. As I was thinking about this subject, I thought about the true Jesus. If you were to ask people on the street now who they think Jesus is, I think I get this a lot in my inbox. I get this on my Twitter feed. You're Jesus or whatever, they fill in the blank, and they would say, you know, Jesus was a socialist. You know, he thought everybody should be the same and equal, or a communist. He was a pacifist. He would not kill anyone in battle or He would not be for the death penalty. He would be for open borders, Jesus would be. Or he wouldn't judge. You know, he loves everyone all the time, no matter what. That's who Jesus is. So during biblical times, they had one view. They thought he was the king and that he was returning. But now everybody thinks that he just loves everybody all the time and wouldn't do or say anything to harm people. Well, who is the true Jesus? That's what David explored in his book. And David, of course, is a lawyer, a nationally syndicated columnist. He's written 7 New York Times bestsellers. He joins us today. David, thanks for joining us.
Sandy, thanks for having me.
All right, you wanted to name this book, Who Do You Say That I Am, didn't you?
Yes, that is right.
But, all right, well,
publisher prevailed with the other name, with the other title.
Well, you know, you read the Gospels are 4 different men writing about the life of the same man. So as you were reading those 4 Gospels, did you find that the man they were talking about, even though they had a different style, different perspective, was the man different in the telling of those 4 Gospels?
You know, you're the first one out of about 80 interviews that has asked me that profound question. And it's true. There's no difference at all in his character. There's just a difference in emphasis in how each author approaches. But the divinity and humanity and sublimity of Jesus just jumps off the pages in each of the 4 Gospels. There's no mistake that they are describing the most unique being who ever lived. And if you read the Gospels, you will encounter the living Son of God. There's no substitute for that.
David, you've been a Christian for a long time and a serious one. This is your second, I think, your second book, The Emmaus Code, was the other one. You've written a lot of political books. That's how people first got to know you as a writer. But you've been very serious about your writing and very serious about your study of theology. When you were reading the Gospels, trying to discern who Jesus was there any element of who you found out he is that surprised you?
No, but in fact, this is my 3rd Christian book. The first one was Jesus on Trial, which described my faith journey from skeptic to believer and also was an apologetic. The Emmaus Code was Jesus in the Old Testament. This book, The True Jesus, is about the Gospels alone. And there's no specific revelation because I've read the Gospels so many times, as you have and so many of your listeners have. But I think the epiphany of sorts that I did have was this. I planned on writing a New Testament introduction for lay people to get people more inspired about the New Testament and to go read it. And as I was researching it, I decided and trying to combine the 4 Gospels into one unified narrative so that I could devote, say, 50 pages to it, and I would have enough pages left over that I could cover the other 23 books of the New Testament. I realized there was just no adequate way to do that, so I called my publisher and asked if we could narrow the focus of this book to the Gospels alone. But what I discovered, Sandy, I have read the epistles too, and the epistles have always been my favorite, if you can have a favorite, because I love theology. And the Apostle Paul, of course, gives us great theological lessons as he writes to the churches, and the letters of Peter and the letters of John and James, they all are so insightful on a theological basis. But what I've discovered, and it's really embarrassing to call it a discovery, but it's not in the sense that I have a child's excitement about it, as I do for the Bible and as I do for Jesus Christ. But my so-called epiphany is that there is no place besides the Gospels that present Jesus unfiltered. No, you don't have to read about what anyone says about him, even the Apostle Paul through the authority of the Holy Spirit, through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. You get to witness Jesus speak for himself. You get to watch him perform his acts. You get to see him encounter and interact with other people. You see how he's the most efficient teacher imaginable because, as Dr. Lynn Kohick says, his actions are combined with his teaching. He's so efficient. He will teach through his actions and then give a speech. He doesn't waste any energy. And that's what is recorded in the Gospels. But the most profound thing is, when you read the Gospels, you will see, with an open mind and open heart, you will see that you are encountering the living Son of God. There is no other creature so sublime, so divine, so human. No fiction writer could have ever created such a creature, such a being. There's finite human beings could not have come up with that story. They couldn't even imagine, give unto Caesar what is Caesar, give unto God what is God. There is no way that they could have depicted a character who could have spoken with the authority that he spoke and exhibited himself as the Son of God all the way through the Scriptures. And all I can tell you is, my book, which is about the Gospels, which is a combined narrative which takes you into the Gospels themselves, covers all the events, all the major speeches, mostly verbatim, and the only time I paraphrase is for the purposes of space. But even though I think my book is helpful to non-readers, helpful to people who want to learn about the Gospels and learn more, and books about Jesus are great because we Christians are supposed to help each other, we're supposed to teach each other, but there is no substitute for reading the Gospels themselves, the Bible themselves. Only there will you encounter the living Son of God. So my goal, shortly stated, is to inspire people to read the Gospels for themselves, open mind, seeking heart. That's a big condition. But I'm telling you, if you read with that attitude as opposed to with the attitude of being your own God and defeating God, you will encounter Christ. Knock and the door will be open. Seek and you shall find. The Gospel, the Bible promises that it has the power of salvation. Take it up. Take God up on his promise, and you will find an entirely new revelation when you read it.
David, I started the segment by talking about kind of the ways people view Jesus now, and I mentioned socialist, pacifist, open borders, and I gave a lot of examples. But, you know, the truth is, I know you will agree with this, when we see Jesus in the Gospels, or we read about him from Paul's perspective in the epistles, and we have a glimpse of, just a glimpse, really, that's all we can get, because it's just too great. We realize how silly those questions are and how irrelevant and how small the even try to put him in a box or discuss these things that we grapple with. He is so much greater. He was the creator, after all. He was present at the foundation of the earth. He was the creator. He just happened to humble himself and put himself inside, you know, become a man and reduce his Godhead. But these questions are small. But nevertheless, we are human beings, and we have to understand him through the lens of our limited humanity. So who really was he in light of some of those things I posited? How can we know?
Okay, well, first thing I want to say is that God presented himself to Moses in the Old Testament, and he told Moses that if he looked upon him, he would literally burn up because he's so intense. You cannot look upon God, the spirit form of God. So what is God like? Well, we know exactly what God is like because he sent his Son in human form to reveal to us exactly who he is. Jesus is the perfect imprint of God. Hebrews tells us he's the perfect imprint. I and the Father are one, is what Jesus said. So encountering Jesus, this God who seems mystifying to us, who seems inscrutable, unknowable to us, has condescended to human form primarily to show us who he is with a human face so we can relate to him, so he can die substitutionarily for us. Now, that's a point that just blows me away. Now, directly to your question, Jesus is not the Jesus depicted by the popular culture who wants to conform Jesus to it. We should conform ourselves to Jesus Christ. He is the way, the truth, and the life. He's not a guy, a pacifist, a hippie, a milquetoast guy skipping through the tulips, promising that love unconditionally for no reason, that he's indifferent to sin, he doesn't care, that if you follow him, you'll be wealthy and healthy. No, he says if you follow him, you're going to have difficulty. He didn't come to bring peace. He came to divide brother against brother, father from daughter, son and father, and in-laws. But the point is not that he's a mean guy, it's that he understands that the world is under the control of evil forces, and the world will not accept him. Therefore, the world that's organized under evil will reject those who follow him. But he is absolutely loving, absolutely compassionate, absolutely forgiving. But you have to make a choice about him. He accomplished his work on the cross. He was born to die, and he demands of us. He laid down the most exacting moral code known to mankind in the Sermon on the Mount and elsewhere. Be perfect as your Father is perfect. So there's no way we can do that unless we appropriate the finished work of Christ on the cross, so that when God looks at us in judgment for salvation purposes, he'll see only Jesus Christ and we'll be declared righteous. But Jesus is not a guy that's indifferent to sin. He cares deeply about sin. And it puts the lie to the notion that we just have to reject the standard, what secular liberals want us to do, the left wants us to do. Abolish the standard because you can't live up to it, you hypocrites, except that we Christians never claim we can live up to it. We claim, in fact, that we can't live up to it. That's why we need a Savior. In fact, I think sometimes we don't realize how sinful we still are, even Christians who are reborn. We still struggle with sin every day, and through the power of the Holy Spirit, hopefully, we defeat it each and every day, but we're never going to be sin-free. So we need to understand, we need to be convicted of our sin, and turn. That's the only way we're going to turn to Christ. And that's why we need to remind ourselves of that in the churches and elsewhere. We are not perfect, we're part of a broken world, and the only answer to that brokenness is Jesus Christ and faith in Jesus Christ and his finished work.
You know, David, yes to all of that. I think one misunderstanding Christian culture has on that point from Jesus is that sometimes Christians use that as an excuse, like, I can't meet the standard, I'm only human, and that's not the point about this at all. I mean, the judgments are righteous and holy. The standard is holiness. But Christians have managed to do incredible things trying to conform their life and their mind to the mind of Christ and through the power of the Holy Spirit. It's a powerful life. It's not a weak, oh, well, what can I do? I'm only human life, is it?
No, no. And I want to be emphatically clear about this. Just because I presented a Jesus who is exacting in his standard, it's because he's a holy God. He's also perfectly merciful. It's just that you don't get there through your own merit. You get there through relying in him, trusting in him. But he's not this mean person. He's exacting because a holy God has to be exacting, but he's also completely gracious and full of grace. And yeah, we have to strive to be holy, but as you say, we do it through the power of the Holy Spirit, largely through the spiritual disciplines, prayer, Bible reading, fasting, and the rest. But don't get the idea that because I'm saying that Christ is demanding that he took the Pharisees, the money changers out of the temple with a whip of cords, that he called the Pharisees hypocrites for their external indicia of righteousness while being internally corrupt. Don't get the idea that he wasn't loving, because we see throughout the Gospels how completely loving he is and how human he was, as well as being deity.
All right, the book is called The True Jesus, Uncovering the Divinity of Christ in the Gospels. It's a great read. It's a New York Times. It's going to be, I don't know where it is on the charts yet, but I'm sure it's moving up. David, have you had good response from this book?
Yeah, it's number 4 on New York Times list on nonfiction hardcover the first week.
Wow, isn't that something? That's really something, David. And I know that your heart and your passion is in this. One of the things he talks about is why the apostles failed to completely understand Jesus' true identity. And why Jesus didn't, he selectively revealed who he was. Sometimes he said, don't tell anybody who I am, or don't tell anybody about this miracle. It's really interesting, the things that David talks about in this book. Again, it's called The True Jesus, Uncovering the Divinity of Christ in the Gospels. David Limbaugh's brand new book, and we just suggest that you get it and share it and read it and make the best use of it. While we still can have the freedom to tell others about the one true God, let's tell them. David, thanks for joining me today on Washington Watch.
Danny, you're a good friend. Thank you so much.
Yes. Yeah, okay, David. Thanks a lot. Okay. Well, Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins. By the way, it's frc.org, frc.org. It's at T. Perkins. That's his Twitter account, at T. Perkins. If you'd like to keep in touch with me, it's at Sandy Rios Tweet, at Sandy Rios Tweet. It's Sandy Rios in the morning. Here on this station at 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
It's a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.